Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode, I am welcoming back Greg Lake onto the podcast here. Today, he is coming in as a lawyer. He is currently litigating a pro bono case in Detroit, Michigan, where a black entheogenic mushroom church was seemingly improperly targeted and raided and shut down. And Greg is currently working on the case, and he feels that it has implications for the broader fight for entheogenic religious freedom in the United States. So he's here today to talk all about it. We will get to that conversation very shortly. But first, just a couple quick announcements. Thanks this week goes out to Brooke and James, who I mention at least once a month because they both have set up monthly contributions in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast via PayPal. Thank you guys very much for your continual and ongoing support. Really appreciate it and enjoy mentioning your names every month. If you would like to support this podcast, like Brooke or James, you can stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net, use the PayPal link at the top right of the page, and you can make a one-time donation support, or you could set up a little monthly support the way that both James and Brooke do. And of course, you can also join up over at my Patreon page, everything from $1 a month up to $100 a month with increasing access, bonuses, and benefits. And you can also just follow my Patreon page for free if you want, just to keep track of what I'm posting over there. And a reminder, I do have my Patreon shop where I have a wide variety of my books available in full color PDF format. As you may know, I like to include my original art and photography in my books, and this way you can get all of that in color, and it's great. And of course, a reminder that my brand new book, 5-MeO-DMT Integration, is now available. It's out there in paperback and ebook and also in PDF format at my Patreon page, patreon.com/martinwball. I've also updated my personal webpage, martinball.net, with information about my new book. And it is out there, and the audiobook is forthcoming sometime this spring. I'll have that ready to go. I want to record some new music to go along with the new audiobook and record the audiobook, but it won't take me all that long to do all that. I haven't started any of that yet. I've been spending a little time doing some artwork, which I've been enjoying, just kind of a, you know, little intermission between larger projects, but that's on tap for what's coming next. It's recording some music, doing the audiobook, and getting that out there. In other news, consultations are going strong with people looking for help integrating their entheogenic experiences and their work with 5-MeO-DMT. Just a reminder that I'm available for 30, 60, and 90-minute video calls. If you want to check out my webpage on that, that's nondualentheogenicintegration.com, or just shoot me an email at martinwball@gmail.com, and I can get you on the schedule. So those are the announcements for now. I've already got a number of new interviews already in the bank waiting to come out here on the podcast, and I've got a couple more lined up before we're taking a couple of weeks off. Things are going strong here on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. And let's go ahead and get into this conversation with Greg Lake discussing this current religious freedom case happening in Detroit, Michigan, that he is working on at a pro bono level. Greg has also set up a Patreon page for himself, which he will mention later in the podcast. He is doing this work pro bono, but if you are someone who feels like you would like to support a lawyer who is doing pro bono work for entheogenic religious freedom, then I'd encourage you to consider supporting Greg and the work that he is doing on this case and also elsewhere. So, here's my conversation with Greg Lake, recorded just a few weeks ago. Enjoy. Okay, well, we are welcoming back onto the Entheogenic Evolution podcast lawyer Greg Lake. And for longtime listeners of the podcast, I'm sure you're familiar with Greg for his work as a lawyer and helping people to set up legal entheogenic and psychedelic churches here in the United States. He's been one of the pioneers of working in this area legally and helping people establish through all the proper paperwork and forms and all the rest of the hoops that people have to jump through in order to make that a reality. And we're having you back on the podcast today to talk about a current court case that I know that you're working on that is related to this topic of religious rights and religious freedoms in the United States in association with entheogens and psychedelics. And so we're going to just be talking all about it today, because this is a currently active case.
Yeah, it's actually one of three that I have right now that I've, over the last, I'm a litigator and appellate attorney by heart, by trade. That's what I really, what really gets my blood going, doing that. And, helping people with the churches has been great, but I really love litigating. And so, yes, this is one of three cases that I have. It's the biggest in the sense that, I think it has the widest impact. You know what I mean? The result in this case, I think, would have the widest impact around, the country as far as, establishing freedoms. It's one of the hardest cases in that the facts are a little bit further beyond, what we know from the UDV and Santo Daime opinions. And so it's kind of extending out how far our freedoms go as far as, in this case, distributing sacraments. Outside of strictly the ceremonial context, per se.
So maybe to get us started, if we could do just a little bit of a review of like what the legal background is in terms of where we are with recognition of entheogenic consumption as a potentially protected religious freedom within this country. And I've had you on, we've talked about it before, but it's always good just to kind of give a little bit of a recap and get some of that history there. So why don't we start there before we talk about the specifics of this case?
No, I think that's great. And, you said something in the beginning that, we talk about, legal versus illegal when we talk about religious practices, right? And protections under, the First Amendment, RFRA, state laws and stuff. And, I just want people to remember, one of the key things to know is that these cases are decided on their facts. Okay. So, just because the UDV or Santo Daime were given, authority and let me back up for just one second is that, our right to religious freedom, belief is absolute,
right?
Practice has limits, right? So we can't have a religion that where you murder people or rape people or really harm people in some way. Obviously that's not legal or protected activity. But when we venture out from there, where we go to like where we're at here with controlled substances laws. These things are decided on a case by case basis, we have these laws that incidentally burden religion. And so, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, when we're talking about the Controlled Substances Act, Congress didn't consider the way that the UDV served DMT or ayahuasca when making DMT a Schedule I substance, or the way that the Santo Daime brewed and served it when they did it. So, just because the UDV and Santo Daime have, gained recognition from the court, that their practice is protected under, in that instance, the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, it doesn't mean by rule that everyone who serves ayahuasca per se is protected in that, right? And so, but I also want to say this too, is that our right to religious exercise, it doesn't exist in a vacuum and is independent of any government recognition or giving us of that right. To say that, you don't have to ask the DEA if you can serve, your sacrament, right? I mean, you literally, your right exists independent of that. Now, it could be called into question and then the courts, will weigh in on that. Correct. But I don't want, one thing I think people get mistaken is that you have to ask permission to engage in religious exercise. These rights are inherent, and inalienable, and again, thank you for our system where we have courts where hopefully we have a neutral and detached magistrate or judge who gets to make the ultimate judgment call and not the DEA who naturally is against us in that. So a lot of times when we say is it legal? Is it not? Well, we can't say for sure, right? Because we would ultimately need to have a trial on the merits with the court, adversarial hearing to really say for sure whether this is protected or not, right? But we have these cases, the Santo Daime, UDV, you know, the Native Americans have their rights statutorily that they fought long and hard for to consume peyote for religious purposes, right? So that's kind of where we're at. But, you know, the UDV and Santo Daime cases are really good because it shows us, one, that if you're engaged in sincere religious exercise, and you can show that, and you can show that it's been substantially burdened in a lot of jurisdictions, the existence of the Controlled Substances Act alone and its inherent threat of prosecution in and of itself creates a substantial burden, then the government has to show a compelling interest in enforcing it blanketly against you, in that, you know, that blanket enforcement is the least restrictive means, because, you know, our First Amendment rights are so precious that if the government's going to burden them, it has to do so in the least restrictive way. Now, sometimes that means completely no practice, right? But if there's any way to give some slack to allow some practice while still protecting the government's interests, it has to do that, right? It has to do it by the least restrictive means, or what they say, narrowly tailored, to, you know, accommodate these competing interests. So, you know, right now we know that, for those of us who can show that we're engaged in a sincere religious exercise, that's been substantially burdened, the government will have to prove a compelling governmental interest. And so from the Santo Daime and UDV cases, as it relates to controlled substances, we know that that analysis usually entails health and safety and diversion. So the government will assert that it has an interest in protecting health and safety of people, the members of the church or members of the public who are going to be engaging or are engaging in these activities. And then two, that these substances aren't being diverted outside of, you know, religious channels into, mm-hmm. What we call recreational, you know. And sometimes when you think about psychedelics, like, what is recreational, you know, because the science tells us that very reliably people have religious experiences with these substances. So that line between recreational and religious gets really blurred, you know, when you think about it on a theoretical basis. So that's kind of where we're at. Now, I do want to say one thing, though, is that there's different standards. So, you know, the First Amendment to the Constitution provides the baseline standard, right? So under the First Amendment, the states are free to provide whatever level of protection that they want for religious exercise. But whatever that standard is under the First Amendment is the baseline. They cannot provide any lower amount of protection than that, right? At the federal level, we have the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, which provides a high level of protection. So what separates those two? Well, under the First Amendment, if a law is generally applicable and neutral, then the government doesn't have to show this high burden, compelling interest, right? They only have to show some kind of rational basis for the regulation, you know, that incidentally burdens religion. Whereas under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and a lot of states have similar acts and have interpreted their constitution to require the same, that it doesn't matter if a law is generally applicable or neutral, the government always has to show a compelling interest, whether the law is generally applicable or not. So this Detroit case is, you know, under the federal law, is under the First Amendment. So, you know, we have to first determine whether the law at issue here, which is the nuisance statute, which incorporates the Controlled Substances Act, whether that is a law of general applicability or neutrality. And if it isn't, then they, you know, the city here will have to show a compelling interest. If it's found to be generally applicable, neutral, they only have to show a rational basis. So this is really cutting edge stuff, because this whole notion of what's generally applicable or neutral, was further defined during COVID in a case called Tandon v. Newsom. And they're really cutting down on this whole notion. And so that's kind of where we're, and I'll stop there for now, but you know, that's kind of where we're at on this case and why it's cutting edge is are state controlled substances laws, because, you know, like the whole West Coast, you know, their state laws, religious freedoms are tied to the First Amendment. So this kind of right now, the lowest level of protection, there's quite a few states that are tied to the First Amendment. So that's kind of a lot of the importance of this particular case when we talk about religious protections.
Yeah. So there's just a few topics here that I'd love to kind of recap for the audience, because I think these are important points to make. So first of all, we do have the notion of religious freedom is built into the Constitution itself. But then, of course, there are questions as to what does that freedom mean? And so one of the points that you raised that I think is really important, and we saw this in the Supreme Court prior to the creation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, is I forget which judge it was, but he said, maybe you know what I'm thinking of, but he said, religious freedom means you can believe whatever you want. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can practice whatever you want. So there's definitely limitations on practice, because as you say, some practices might interfere with other people's exercise of their First Amendment rights, such as right to life. Like if my religion says we need human sacrifices, you know, that's a place where it's a, hey, but the person you're sacrificing, they have a right to life. And then sometimes when dealing with belief issues, we even have to take a neutral stance. Like I think in Florida, at one point there was a case where a voodoo religious group was ritually sacrificing chickens.
City of Hialeah. Yep. Okay. That's one of the very like landmark First Amendment cases. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And they tried to outlaw that. Yep. And I think it just came down to a belief where the people who wanted to outlaw it said, well, we don't like that belief. We think that's bad. We think that's witchcraft, you know, probably coming from a Christian perspective. But then the counter argument is, hey, people kill chickens all the time.
Yep, that's right.
They eat chickens all the time. We're just doing it in a different context that makes you uncomfortable. Therefore, your beliefs do not get to dominate over my beliefs, and we're not hurting anyone. Yeah, we're killing chickens, but people kill chickens.
That's right.
Right? Okay. That's right. So then the next point of like with the specific cases that have gone forward, the Santo Daime and the UDV, sometimes I do hear people talk about those cases and they say, yeah, and that legalized ayahuasca as a religious sacrament in the United States. And there the response is absolutely no, it did not do that.
Yeah, no.
It made it legal for members of the Santo Daime Church and the UDV Church to do that, but it didn't overall at a general level legalize ayahuasca for religious purposes. And the same goes with the peyote through the Native American Restoration Freedom Act, that it applied to Native Americans who are registered members of a federally recognized tribe have legal access to peyote, but it didn't generally make that available. And then as the point you made with states creating their own religious freedom acts, one of the responses here in Oregon was then to say, well, here in Oregon, we're going to say that peyote, access to peyote as a religious sacrament is open to anyone, regardless of their racial or ethnic heritage or background. So it made it universally applicable, but only in Oregon. That doesn't apply to any other state in the United States. So that then it is this case-by-case basis that all of these things have to work their way through the court system. And also, as you say, a group can go ahead and start practicing, but then there's always the possibility that the authorities will come in and say, hey, you're using an illegal substance. And so at that point, then it becomes an issue for the courts to see, is this a legitimate religious practice? And I think this last point that you raised, I think is really significant, that people spontaneously and unintentionally, not even looking for it, have religious and spiritual experiences on psychedelics. Somebody could be at a Grateful Dead concert and say, that was the most profound religious experience of my life.
Yes.
And so psychedelics kind of inherently blur that line between what is just recreational use and not protected versus what is spiritual or religious use and therefore protected. Yeah. And often it comes down to, was it in an organization that we can identify as being overtly religious or not? You know,
I like to use, you know, for me, because I think this is another very common misconception that people have, Martin, is that, you know, my ability to have a protected religious belief or really a protected practice is dependent on being associated with some other person or group, which is not true, because see, all of the first 10 amendments save and except the right to assemble, just because that by its nature requires more than one person. These are all individual liberties. Okay. And so with that being said, sure, if you're identified with a group of people, you know, that's in the larger, the better, it's easier for a court to, you know, pin down this is a religion, but make no mistake, that is not a requirement to have a religious belief and practice cognizable under the First Amendment. And we know that from the, you know, really the conscientious objector cases, Seeger and Welch back in Vietnam. You know, nobody, you know, the court noted in both those cases that the people said, and we don't know of anybody who believes what these people believe, but we definitely find them very sincere. And, you know, in our opinion, the substance of what they're telling us rises to the level of being religious. And so really what it is it's just it's a matter of proof and evidence. It's easier to prove that you're part of a religion, actually, you know, a religion when you're associated with a group of people versus when it's just you. But make no mistake about it. If you go to court, you by yourself, and the court finds you to be sincere in what you're telling them or documents that you may have or text, you know, and here's another thing is that, you know, academic text can be used to help show or bolster religion. So in particular, I want to give a shout out to Michael Winkleman, who is an anthropologist from Arizona State University, who spent his career studying ancient shamanism. And he wrote a paper a couple years ago surveying all the evidence from around the world of ancient entheogen use. And he basically concluded that the use of entheogens, and, you know, when we think of entheogens, we think about generally psychedelics. But really, even though that's mostly what he's talking about, he was saying really any consciousness altering substance used for purposes of divination, it occurred all over the world in ancient times, and particularly with mushrooms, both, you know, psilocybin and then other psychoactive mushrooms around the world, amanitas. He said, you know, to him, he said, it's our universal religious heritage to these practices, right? So what that means is that, you know, here's what I tell everybody. If you're an individual and you go to court and you say, Judge, the consumption of sacred psilocybin mushrooms is my religious practice, two pieces of evidence would bolster your case without being associated with any group. One, all the clinical trials showing that people, I think right now they say like 70 to 80% of people in clinical trials in four white walls. And mind you, you know, a couple of years ago, Matthew Johnson went off and said, we need to completely sterilize these rooms of any notion of spirituality. No more Buddha statues, none of that stuff. Literally four white walls in a lab coat with blindfolds, 70-80% of people are having primary religious mystical experiences, scientifically verifiable. And then the second piece, you know, and not that, okay, and let me say this, is that historical antecedents or lineages are not required either, but are very helpful. So I point to Michael Winkleman's academic work, right? So you have two very strong pieces of academic work that really – in that, you know, those two things, unless the court just thinks that you're insincere for some other reason, you know, to me, that wins the day, unless you're doing something unsafe that the court could show that, you know, well, you know, yeah, it's a religion, you're sincere, but you're putting other people at harm or you're disturbing others' peace. But yeah, I just want to make that clear to people that, like, you know, you don't have to be part of a group of people to have a valid religious practice that's cognizable under the First Amendment and worthy of protection. Is it harder to prove that up? Yes, it is. But is it impossible? No. And that's really a lot of the work that I do when I consult people on building these churches. It's really what I call enshrining your rights under the First Amendment. And it's just putting together, you know, general belief statements and, you know, just talking about ceremonies and stuff, because for me, that's the dividing line between recreational use of psychedelics and religious use of psychedelics is set and setting. That we know is so important. Are you building an altar? Are you engaging in a dieta? You know, all these other kind of ancillary things around the use. Really, for me, if I were a judge or if I were to write the law, that would be for me the dividing line between people who are, you know, doing this for fun and then people who are doing this for, you know, religious purposes. Although, to full disclosure, my personal opinion is I don't really care why people consume anything. They're free to put whatever they want in their body. But, you know, that's just kind of the dynamics I want to make clear to people, to know that don't feel like you have to be associated with other people to have a protected practice. You can do this all on your own. But just understand that your evidentiary burden going into court, especially if there's no public evidence, like, for instance, social media is great for people to show sincerity. I mean, you know, like if you have a bunch of posts about your ceremony, photos of your altar, you know, things that you were revealed and, you know, all that's great evidence to show, you know, your religion, right? But if you're purely underground and nobody's ever heard anything about this being your religious practice, and the first time this is being said is in defense to a criminal charge, you're fighting an uphill battle. And so that's kind of the work I do, is try to help people, you know, through building an actual nonprofit organization with a corporate record that has these documents in them that are easily admissible, right? Where we're building that evidentiary record where, God forbid, we ever end up in court, we have a very easily admissible, highly probative piece of evidence that judges love to look at. And would rather look, you know, they would rather make a determination based on documents than going through court transcripts that might be a little bit all over the place. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, those are some really great points. And so I just want to recap some of those. Again, this idea that religious freedom is afforded to individuals, not groups, so that you can claim your religious freedom as an individual. You don't need to be a member of a church or a religious organization. It does potentially make it harder because it's much easier to, if you can go to court and say, well, this is my church, this is my community, these are our doctrines, these are our rituals, these are our practices, this is our lineage. But none of that is actually required by the Constitution itself. And I also like this point that you made of, if you are more public and open about your spiritual or religious approach to your use of entheogens, that actually can serve as evidence within court. So it's this weird catch 22 that people find themselves where they're
exactly
like,
what I tell people,
it's like, I don't want to draw attention to myself. So I want to keep it underground. I want to keep it secret, but then it actually makes it harder to prove for the courts, because they might say, well, you're just telling us that now because you're in court.
That's right.
And so it comes down to that question of sincerity. Is this a sincere religious belief? And can we find evidence that you've actually held this belief and you're not just blowing smoke up our ass here in court trying to make it sound like you're actually sincere about this, but we don't have any evidence for that. So it can actually be to someone's benefit and protection if they do document this in some way and actually are somewhat public about it and at least sharing that with others, so that then we can bring in witnesses like, oh, well, did Greg tell you that he had a spiritual experience last weekend at the Grateful Dead show? Yep, he sure did.
Yeah.
Yep. He told me all about it. He told me so much that I had to tell him, okay, that's enough. So that can actually serve you. But of course, that's where it gets edgy for people with that scheduled status at the federal level. And of course the states that, you know, might want to quote, make an example of someone or whatever. So it's this weird legal limbo that people are in. And it's very, for many people, it's totally uncharted territory. And that's what makes the court cases that set precedents that's what makes them so significant and important.
Very important. So important, man. Yeah. So important. Right now, we're at such a critical point in this because, you know, we have the Santo Daime and UDV opinions, 2006, 2009 for Santo Daime, right? But, you know, since then, this movement and really COVID was the catalyst for a lot of where we're at today, this movement into, man, it's this thing. You know, I actually cited this in a court, in a federal court filing the other day, but there's religious experts that believe that right now, as of today, while there's approximately 3,000 to 4,000 entheogenic churches and then just other groups that regularly meet and commune together, that right now the U.S. actually probably needs about 10,000 to adequately meet the needs, spiritual needs of people, you know, in this country right now who are moving in that direction of communing with entheogens as their primary mode of religious spiritual practice.
Yeah, it's one of these very interesting social phenomenons where identification with well-established, traditional, organized religious bodies and institutions, that has been dropping off consistently over recent decades. Mm-hmm. But what we're still left with is human beings who have religious and spiritual urgings and desires. And so it's where are people going to find that personal, psychological, social need, where are they going to have that met? And a lot of people are turning to psychedelic experience to fulfill these. And often it comes with the claim that my experience with mushrooms was way more sacred and impactful than anything I ever got going to church.
Heard a lot of that, and I'll get to it in a bit. But the Detroit case, I've some very compelling testimony in that regard that I've heard from members.
Yeah. So in that sense, this case in Detroit is fulfilling a societal need or at least a societal demand, that there is a demand for spiritual experience through psychedelics and entheogens. Mm-hmm. And now we've got a court case here. So let's get into what are the details? What's the background? Yeah. What's the case all about, and what's going on, and how is it going to impact the landscape?
Trying to think where best place to start. Well, so my client, his name is Robert Schumacher, but he goes by the name Shaman Shu. He grew up, basically his whole family, from his mother to basically his whole family are Christian ministers and involved in Christianity in one way or another. Now, he actually ended up doing corporate, and he's an African-American man, but he ended up doing corporate real estate kind of as his thing. But he's been involved in religion his entire life, you know. And so he ended up in 2021, I think, at Rhythmia in Costa Rica, had his first ayahuasca experience, right? So, you know, a person who's been involved in religion their entire life, like, and this kind of goes back to what you were just saying, like, was completely blown open. He said, oh my God. And, you know, the medicine spoke to him very strongly and told him that, you know, when you get back to Detroit, like, you need to liberate the city, you know, liberate the city. And so when he got back, he ended up then working with sacred mushrooms, and the mushrooms really had some instructions for him. And they told him first that he needed to, again, liberate the city through passing a decriminalization measure. So he hit streets and was successful. I think not the first round of elections after, but the second, he was able, 61% of the voters approved to decriminalize entheogenic plant medicines in Detroit, and with two exceptions that are above and beyond what we know. And one, it's basically this, is that a therapist can trade their services with entheogens for remunerations, and as well as spiritual leaders and organizations can trade, you know, for remuneration for these entheogens, right? And but let me make this point though, is that that's not really the decriminalization point isn't super important for purposes of this case, because obviously it's, you know, decriminalization just puts this at the lowest end of law enforcement priority. Now, for our civil rights claims, it's important just to show, you know, intention that the city had, but, you know, ultimate legality, it's not that important, but he was guided to do that. And then, you know, after that, he was guided to start his own ministry. And his mother unfortunately passed away not too long after that. And on her deathbed, you know, told him that she wished that he would take over her ministry, which was international. She had followers in Africa, all over these places. And so he took it over and, you know, was doing basically online prayers for, and they were being spread all over the world, Africa and all that stuff. But he ended up founding Soul Tribes Ministries. And initially what he did is he went around the city holding mushroom ceremonies for, again, largely a predominantly African-American demographic of all strata of the society, from drug dealers and murderers all the way up to corporate CEOs and things. And I think over the course of a year, he had served over 150, 200 people successfully. You know, people went through his ceremonies and had these incredible experiences. And, you know, there were some people, his members I've spoke to, that were 70 years old and had been going to Sunday service at Christian churches. There were some people who had been Muslim for a part of their life, Christian for a part of their life, but they all told me, they said that this experience with Shu, they basically said this. They were like, look, you know, we've been trying to walk a spiritual path our entire life and we've lived good lives, but we've always known there was something there just kind of holding us back from that, you know, that extra step to the highest version of ourselves, in that, you know, the mushroom showed them exactly what it was. And moreover, gave them the power and courage to wake up the next day and go handle business. And so, you know, that's kind of where all this started. And then, you know, him being the real estate man, he ended up buying with his own funds a 98-year-old church building in Detroit that basically takes up the whole city block. But it had always been traditionally a Christian church. So he purchased the church building and started doing reservations. And mind you, he there was still a group of Christian church parishioners that had been doing services and Bible studies there that he continued to let do it, you know, like share the building with them. And what happened is it was in September of last year, he opened the doors of the church. And what he was doing was allowing people to come into the church, get screened, fill out some paperwork, and if he felt it was appropriate, he was allowing them purchase sacrament and take it home with them, right? You know, with and it wasn't just like anyone could walk in and purchase it. You know, they had to be a member, identified, and did get some education and leave with sacrament. And the city took major issue with that. And now, mind you, there are tons of white-owned secular businesses in Detroit, and I'm actually going up there this weekend to check all this out. But according to him, there's a lot of secular owned white businesses that are openly advertising and selling mushrooms and other plant-based psychedelics without issue. So what ended up happening was right when they opened, he went unilaterally himself to the local police and just reached out to them and talked to the director of community policing, had a face-to-face meeting for about 2 hours and just told them, like, hey, here's who I am. Here's what my ministry is. Here's, you know, generally our beliefs. Here's how we feel we are protected. We are here to try to better our community. And we want to work with the police and other city officials in that regard. We're open to having a conversation with city officials to see how we can balance our interests and work together to make sure everyone's good. And, you know, at the end of that conversation, it was kind of like, okay, you know, we're going to try to make this happen. Well, in the interim, the police had sent several undercovers into the church house trying to purchase sacrament, but because they failed to identify themselves and go through the process, we're never able to purchase sacrament. And so what ended up happening is that they got a search warrant and they basically raided the church with a full SWAT team with assault rifles and everything, despite the fact that, A, they knew that these people were completely peaceful, completely upfront and in integrity about what they were doing. And the fact that they presented no threat to anybody. And they were doing basically what so many other institutions across the city were doing. So, yeah, they raided them and took all their sacrament. They took some industrial hemp, unregulated, that he was going to make some CBD oils with, because for him, CBD oils were for anointing and for, you know, healing purposes. And they took it. And basically within a week, they filed a nuisance lawsuit against him, a civil suit. Nuisance per se, but for having controlled substances in the property and distributing them, right? Unfortunately for him, his lawyers that he got to represent him on that were not, they were well intentioned, but there's just not many lawyers in this country who are really, really, really well versed on these First Amendment type issues. And they lost, and so they got an injunction. The city completely shut down the church. Since then, the church has been abandoned and vandalized, and all the renovations, it's just completely gone downhill. And through the course of that, the very end of the state court proceedings, I eventually got in, and Shu himself, not me, filed a removal to federal court. So when you're in state court, you can file what's called a removal and ask the federal court to take the case. And it stops the state court jurisdiction and pending the federal court decision. And so that's kind of where we're at now, with the exception, or with the addition that tonight I'm going to be filing a 100-page civil rights complaint against, I think, almost 25 of the city employees involved in all this, right? Because there were a lot of civil rights violations. I'll just put it to you like that. And so, but the unique question here in the federal court is, you know, again, under this First Amendment standard, does strict scrutiny apply? Compelling interest, right? Because if the law is generally applicable or neutral under federal First Amendment law, then all the city has to show is a rational basis. But if it's declared not generally applicable or neutral, they have to show a compelling interest. And, you know, we know that with the state of the science on psilocybin safety, that's going to be a hard sell. So I want to talk real quick about what separates a law of general applicable or neutral law versus one that's not. And this came from a case during COVID called Tandon v. Newsom out of California. It was a COVID case. And the Supreme Court said this, and this is very important. It said, if you have a law that otherwise appears generally applicable and neutral, so in the whole time, let's think about Controlled Substances Act, because the Newsom statute, their church was allegedly a violation of the nuisance statute and unlawful because of it was selling controlled substances, right? But the U.S. Supreme Court basically says that if there is a law that has secular exceptions, these secular exceptions pose the same or greater risk than the religious activity at issue, then it's not a law of general applicability or neutral, and it's subject to strict scrutiny. So here's the question. Is things like a pharmacist handing a bottle of fentanyl patches, which might or might not have a childproof top to it, to an end user, is that riskier and more dangerous to the public health than someone walking out of a church who's been screened for spiritual and health purposes with a quarter ounce of dried psilocybin mushrooms? Obviously, our argument and our expert says that no, the secular activity poses a lot more risk to right. health and safety than this, right? So if that's the case, then the court, then they have to show a compelling interest, right? So this is really cutting edge, because this new idea of what's a generally applicable neutral law came out of COVID, and it's been applied in other contexts, but this is the first time that it's been applied in the context of religion in the Controlled Substances Act, and whether these religious activities, the risk involved with them, are, you know, equal or less than those of the secular exemptions to the Controlled Substances Act. And so that is, you know, on top of, is this a religious, actual religious activity? You know, that's another one. And, you know, let me comment on that real quick, is that, you know, Shaman or Shu's been a religious man his entire life. The belief system really incorporates a lot of different indigenous traditions, as we see, you know, with a lot of in theogen-based practitioners in this country. Really, it's a syncretic religion, a mix of different indigenous traditions with Hindu traditions, with Buddhist traditions, with some Christian elements to it, just a real syncretic mix of religious traditions balled into one. And so very interesting and very profound questions, but it's one of those things that if we go and win under this baseline First Amendment standard, that means anywhere you're at in this country, you're in a good position practicing within theogens. Does that make sense? Did I explain that kind of well? If there's any kind of, you know, let me know and I can explain a little further.
Yeah. So just let me ask you about the situation in Detroit itself. So I know that you said that you're going to go this weekend to actually check this out, but this seems like a very problematic case for the city itself.
That
if there are shops that you could walk into and buy mushrooms and walk out of and take those home, it really raises the question of, well, then why did you target the church that even came to the police and said, this is what we're doing, and then try to do a sting operation? So that even appears to be a religiously biased application of the law itself.
Yep.
Do they have a response to this, or is this what's going to be coming out in the court case?
Here's another element to it. I told you they seized about 100 pounds of industrial hemp. They submitted it to the state lab, according to the documents, the same day as the raid. We've yet to see the results, yet in multiple pleadings since that time, the city attorney, who I'm also suing, by the way, still maintains that it's illegal marijuana. But what's funny is that the local councilman, the city councilman, his wife has a marijuana dispensary in the same precinct.
Oh,
it's funny. Yeah, it's real funny. A lot of things going on up there in Detroit. And you know, I lived in South Louisiana and practiced law, maritime law there for a while, and where I really started practicing this law. And there's some pretty corrupt stuff going on there. Don't get me wrong. There's a good old boy network, South Louisiana. What I'm seeing in Detroit, like every day when I wake up and talk to my client, I wonder how deep this conspiracy goes. Like, it's, I mean, literally almost every day, there's another defendant that I have to add. That's why it's taken so long to even get it out, because I've literally had to add more and more people every day. And I'll say this too. My client recently, about 2 weeks ago, contracted with the St. Regis Hotel there because he wanted to do an energy breathwork Amanita, a legal mushroom session, you know, for him, a religious service of sorts, right? So he contracted with them. Didn't happen because the city law department called the St. Regis Hotel and told them that if they followed through, they were going to pull their liquor license.
And the justification for that is
none other than that's back to what I was saying about least restrictive means, narrowly tailored. You know, obviously the subject of the original court proceeding was the controlled nature of the sacrament. But now we see that it has nothing to do with the sacrament, with the controlled nature of the sacrament. So that boils it down to the nature of just the religious practice generally, or unfortunately, the color of my client's skin, because the law department are white people.
Yeah, because basically this fits within the category of harassment, that there is no legal justification for telling someone that, A, you can't have a ceremony with Amanita because there are no laws anywhere any books about Amanita mushrooms.
That's right.
And so there is no legal basis for telling a hotel or other institution that you can't have this kind of event.
That's right.
So that's just – that's basically abusive policing, that it's using the authority of the police to get people to do what they want, and there's zero legal basis for whatsoever.
Yeah. I think there's mixed unconstitutional intentions here. Like, for instance, that Councilman James Tate, he's an African-American man. I think for him, it's financial. You know, he doesn't want this church operating because it might take money away from his wife's dispensary. Right. For the other officials involved who are white, unfortunately, I think it's because it's an African-American church, and probably also, too, because it's a church. It's a religion. And when you read through the documents, you know, there is no analysis by them of whether this is a valid religion or not. It's just automatically assumed that because they are, you know, selling sacrament for remuneration, it can't be valid, but I'll just let everybody know that there's a 1940s U.S. Supreme Court case called Murdoch versus Pennsylvania. And the court in dicta explains it. And they say, look, just because there's a commercial element to an otherwise religious practice does not take it out of the realm of being religious, right? Otherwise, we turn Sunday communion and passing of the offering plate into a purely commercial enterprise. It's not that. People, religions, churches have to make money to remain an ongoing concern. And not every church just gets thousands of dollars of donations every single Sunday. You know what I mean? And so this is perfectly and you know, Shu, in his defense, I mean, he put his personal funds up to buy like a very expensive and a piece of property, you know, and like, sure, he wanted to get paid back and have money for the church and stuff. And with the sacrament, I mean, and moreover, you know, equity of energy exchange is one of their religious beliefs. You know what I mean? That, and I promise you, if someone came in and they were completely broke and needed spiritually to work with this, he would have found something for them to do there that would have, you know, compensated for whatever. I mean, he's not like, you better have the money or we're not, it's not that, right? It's just the equity of energy exchange. But just so people know, and moreover, another thing, you know, under the tax code, nonprofits, churches, they can sell goods and services that are consistent with their exempt purposes, unlimited amounts, as long as it's consistent with that. And so under the tax code, what they were doing was perfectly congruent. And one other thing I want to highlight about when we talk about inequity or equal protection, you know, the Catholic Church serves alcohol to minors in between the ages of 10 and 21. And the same nuisance statute that they brought against my client, three subsections down, the D, is basically the same thing, but talking about alcohol, doing illegal things with alcohol, right? So almost every Catholic church in the city of Detroit for centuries has been violating the exact same statute. And I mean, I didn't do a ton of searching, but I did some little bit of searching. I've yet to find an instance where they were raided, or given any trouble at all. And just so you know, we also are making an excessive force claim for the raid because, you know, they had extensive contact with them before the raid. Nothing indicated that there was any kind of weapons there, any kind of other narcotics there. Or that there were any exigent circumstances to justify 15 armed police officers holding them at gunpoint for over 15 minutes, kicking the door in and all that. So that's another thing. Last thing I want to say, never undervalue your First Amendment rights. The Supreme Court has been clear that, you know, if the police know that the items that they seek to seize, search and seize have First Amendment claims attached to them, unless there's an exigent circumstance where they think that it's going to be destroyed or, you know, lost in some way, the First Amendment requires a prior adversarial hearing where you get to argue in front of a neutral judge your argument that it's protected versus the government why it's not. And then the judge gets to determine whether it is or not. And then if some is, some isn't, they get to craft the search warrant based upon that. Here, the judge was never told about any of this prior contact, about any of the claims. All judge was told is that they're selling this out of a purported church. You know, like all the language they use just assumes that this is an invalid religion. But I can tell you, and you know, Martin, what is and what is not religious is not a question that a normal police officer or really most lawyers are competent to really opine or make a decision on. And unfortunately, most judges aren't either. Right. And that's just the reality that we live in.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it just sounds like everything on the city of Detroit's side and the police department of Detroit, it all sounds really shady. It sounds really selectively applied.
Yes.
They're not making a concerted effort to go across the board and deal with what they might perceive as similar issues in other contexts. Mm-hmm. So it seems that it's specifically targeted to this church, that there was an overuse of force. There was a negligent application of First Amendment freedoms and considerations in doing all of this. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like a really losing case for them and a very winning case for you. So are you at the point where it has been moved to federal court? Where are you at in that process?
So we're here, you know, let's talk about the removal issue real quick. Now, unfortunately, on the removal issue, we don't have the strongest argument because it was a violation of state law, brought in state court, you know, but my argument on removal is that, okay, yes, sure, it's all state law, but really it's really all First Amendment, right? Because all of this is based upon the constitutionality of the statute under the First Amendment, because what's lawful or unlawful under the statute is completely at the discretion of the prosecuting attorney. It doesn't define it in the statute, but by implication, you assume that it's the Controlled Substances Act which determines whether these controlled substances being stored and distributed as property is lawful or unlawful. So in that vein, we're now to the analysis of whether this is a generally applicable or neutral law. And again, you know, there are being narcotics distributed by pharmacists and doctors every single day. That, you know, there are over-the-counter medicines and alcohol being distributed that the body count compared to psilocybin, I mean, there's just not even any comparison that it's not even a question, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just to make it explicit, I mean, anyone can go into a pharmacy or drugstore. You can pick up a bottle of Tylenol. Mm-hmm. If you take that home and if you take too many Tylenols, you're dead.
And it happens a lot.
Yeah.
It happens. I mean, if you looked at the numbers, I mean, I think it's like thousands of people every year die from either intentionally or unintentionally taking too much ibuprofen or Tylenol, their liver shuts down.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's easy access to highly damaging and dangerous substances.
Yes.
So that the whole argument of like, whoa, well, psilocybin is dangerous. And that's also a place where, as you say, the scientific evidence is pretty clear. Mm-hmm. We're not actually dealing with something that's dangerous at that level. We're not talking about a toxic substance.
No, psilocybin on a physical level is more or less perfectly safe.
Yeah.
Really the only real, so for some people with heart conditions, things like that, don't get me wrong, not perfectly physically safe, but when we talk about in comparison to other things readily accessible, absolutely.
Yeah.
Really. And so our expert, who's Peter Hendricks from the University of Alabama, Birmingham, who did an FDA clinical trial with psilocybin for cocaine addiction, he looked at the facts of the case and he said, you know, basically, their membership form says that they recommend people talk to a doctor before they consume it. He said, that's about the best you can do. He said, dude, obviously, I'm a doctor. I prefer people do this in a medical setting. But he said, this causes me little to no concern. The experts. And that's the thing. That's why I love these religious cases. It's because we no longer have to rely on the judgment of a bunch of old racist white men, unfortunately, from the 60s, 70s, We no longer have to rely on their judgment about these things. We can actually bring in new scientific evidence and really figure out whether the government has an interest in enforcing this or not, you know. Yeah. And that's why I love these cases. And I'll just tell you my personal spiritual experience early on. The mushrooms told me, they said, Greg, don't worry about science. That's going to play out. It already is. You see it. Just chill.
Yeah.
You need to make it your mission to master the definition of religion under the First Amendment. And that's what I've set out to do. And I see why, because so many people are stuck, and most of the government is stuck in this completely westernized 500-year-old paradigm of holy book, dogma, hierarchy, a big group definition of religion. But really, what we're talking about with entheogens in these direct primary experiences, that is the foundation. That is the quintessence of religion, right? Because you don't get stories about burning bushes without talking about primary religious first, you know, experiences. And moreover, you know, with these holy books are only 500, 600 years old. Well, what did people do before then? They were illiterate. They experienced religion. There was oral traditions, but it was experienced through, and it wasn't just with entheogens. There was a lot of entheogen use, but tons of different practices. But this whole notion of a book and what, you know, what is your religion, talking about all these different beliefs, that's only 500 or 600 years old. And part of my mission in the legal work that I do is just trying to pull people out of that paradigm and have people understand that it's okay to have these experiences and have your own beliefs. And moreover, you know, a lot of my most profound religious beliefs, I can't really express to you in human language, you know, but I feel it here. And I know it affects the way this thing works, you know, but this right here can't really put that together in a way to relay it to you, but it's still very, very real and powerful. And we need, as a society, to start understanding that and respecting that and fostering that for people. Because if we don't, then really religion dies. If we stop people from having ready access to things that can effectuate these types of experiences, religion and spirituality is on its way to its deathbed, in my opinion. And so that's why I feel like these cases and this work that you do, that I do, is so important, because it's so needed right now, because, you know, a lot of people just don't believe the same things, you know, and that's okay. And we need to foster an idea that you can be a religious person and have your own ideas about things. You know, it's perfectly okay. Like, people ask me all the time, like, well, what should I believe? Whatever makes you feel at whole and peaceful and treat other beings in this world with respect and dignity, believe that. You know, that's it. That's it for me. And so, yeah, this, what we're doing, it's just a whole paradigm shift. But, and it's cyclical. You know what I mean? I think that we're just coming back to where we were 500, 600 years ago, where we left off, back to people really just experiencing religion and it being more about community than about hierarchy. And I think that's where we need to go, in my opinion, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I love about court cases that you've brought up here is that it's still one place, at least in American society, where we can say expertise and knowledge actually does matter, and facts actually
absolutely
do matter.
It makes or breaks cases. Expert testimony makes or breaks cases. I couldn't stress that enough, you know. And I talked to a lawyer in California the other day who was kind of on the cutting edge of cannabis litigation. And he said, look, no matter what you do, he said, you try to get the best experts that you can, because whether you win or lose, that expert testimony in the court record, that builds upon itself over time, and it's super important. And so I want to say thank you so much to Dr. Hendricks at UAB, who has offered to do an opinion for free. If, you know, obviously if he needs to come testify, we'll pay to get him there and all that. But as far as like writing a declaration for the court record, offered to do it for free. God bless him. And, you know, that's that right there is, you know, unfortunately, a lot of these researchers and scientists are financially staked in this whole notion of purely clinical medical use. And, you know, funny is that when you talk to them, this science of it being safe in all religious experiences and stuff, when you talk about churches, conveniently, it's not as powerful of scientific evidence as it is, you know, in reality for them. And you know, Dr. Hendricks is not that person. He's completely honest and calling it how it is. And God bless him. You know, I didn't know if I was going to be able to find someone to really, really stand up for these churches like that.
Yeah. So in terms of coming on the show and informing the public about this case that's going on. I was under the impression that there's ways that people could help. So is that something that we could address here that like,
yeah,
people are interested in this case and say, hey, this sounds like this might be a game changer. What's going on in that area? How can people be involved or help?
Well, to be honest with you, financially, man, you know, I'm litigating all these cases pro bono. I'm donating up to about $30,000-$40,000 a month in legal fees without compensation. And I'm not financially solvent right now. You know, my wife and I had plans to get out of this rent house we're in and stuff like that. And, you know, my decision to step up and you know, apply my trade, you know, has very much negatively impacted my life. And, you know, the finances, just like help to, you know, I'm doing everything. You know, this case in Detroit with all these civil rights claims, like, should properly be with a firm with probably 10 plus lawyers and paralegals and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm working 16 and plus hours a day on this, man. Barely losing, you know, barely sleeping, barely able to afford to pay my bills and stuff. And like, you know, but I just understand so intimately and deeply how important this case is to what so many people are doing. And to be honest with you, I don't even have time to reach out and ask people for help. And so thank you very much for letting me come on today. And like, I have a Patreon page, patreon.com/GeorgeGregLake, where I share all the cutting edge knowledge and do hour long lectures on these topics and stuff. And like, you know, buying a membership there or just, you know, and if someone wants to make a large donation, I have a nonprofit that I can get you a tax write off. But like it would help because like if things keep going the way they are, we might win this case, but like I might not be, you know, a functioning person by the end of this, the way it's kind of going now. I mean, I say that, but it's tough, man. It's been really tough. But you know, for me in my spirituality, more so than taking the medicine, it's these trials and tribulations that make me stronger spiritually, you know. I was homeless on the streets for many years. And you know, that's the thing is that I was a drug addict for 17 years. I was homeless on the streets for 3 years. And I've gone through many, many, many things that most people there's some people that are just amazed that I'm even alive today. So I know I'm going to make it through it. But if anybody could just help support financially, you know, to help me pay my bills and like to have some help, to have some self-care time, I would be grateful beyond, you know, because I don't, You know, it's man, when I tell you, it's like all my friends are like going sitting in ceremony and going and doing breath work and all this stuff. And like, I'm here fighting for their right to be able to do that, you know, without fear or worry or, and not only that, more importantly, for our posterity, for our children.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just want to do my part just to say thank you for doing this work, because it does need to be done, and that these are relevant legal and social issues. They do have major impacts for how future cases are decided. We are talking about fundamental parts of the Constitution, fundamental freedoms, First Amendment rights, and that there's a lot of talk about our freedom and our rights in this country. And, you know, people they actually have to support the work, and that you're out there doing this pro bono. And I want to applaud you for that. And also just say that you shouldn't have to be doing this pro bono, that this is absolutely work that you deserve compensation for.
Yeah.
And so I just want to help plug that Patreon page that you put together, patreon.com/George Greg Lake. Mm-hmm. And I just want to encourage people to reach out to you if this is an issue that they're passionate about, if they have expertise that they can lend, if they have finances that they can lend. This is something that should be a wider grassroots movement in that sense, because it does impact a lot of people, and a lot of people are trying to make progress in this area, but it does require people coming together. And we do live in a monetary society, a monetary economy. You can't get shit done without money. So it's just an opportunity for people to actually put their money where hopefully their heart and their mind is.
Yeah. And I'll say this too, you know, people, like, if you've got a group and y'all have been thinking about maybe organizing and doing a church, you know, a religious nonprofit, like, even hiring me right now to help you do that, you know, that helps too. You know, that's basically, I've been supporting myself is, you know, not been able to take as much work as I was doing, unfortunately. I'm willing to exchange and work for the money, you know what I mean? But like, I've just something to help my financial situation. Like I say, we've got the most expense and most litigation is experts. And we have, you know, Dr. Hendricks, who's offered for free to do his opinion. And, you know, God forbid, if we need to go to trial and have him come up there and testify, well, we'll make that happen, you know. But unfortunately, you know, with me and my addictive past and stuff like that, when I do a month's worth, the 16-hour days, man, there's some times where I go missing for 3 or 4 days. I just get up from my computer and say, fuck it, you know, and sorry for using the language, but like, sometimes it's just gets to that point, and like, I just need some self-care time, but I got to be able to afford it, you know, any support will help and will be noted. And I'll say this, the people who have come through and supported and stuff like that, when these cases are won and people want help and they want to get the government to work with them to have their stuff protected and stuff, I remember those people, right? So just know that if you help support this in the future, if there's things that you need, I'm there. Like, you know, the people I work with, my church clients, you know what I tell them? God forbid anything ever happened, you just call me. We'll talk about energy exchange later. That'll be the last thought, you know. But, you know, people that otherwise, like right now, we'd have to talk about energy exchange up front, unfortunately, just because I'm that stretched that far thin. But there's another case in North Carolina I'm doing with two very deeply experienced and religious ayahuasca practitioners, two ladies. And we've been fortunate back then when the first cases I picked up, I had a lot of more time and I was able to get some donors together and stuff like that. And we were able to get local counsel and stuff. But literally this case in Detroit has just been so much so quick that like I literally even had time to like – sometimes eat. Sometimes I don't even eat the whole day, just because it's that intense. And, finance would help. and anybody who's willing to reach out and help, thank you very much. And I'm willing to exchange some of my time and my expertise to make it worth your while. And my whole Patreon channel is based upon energy exchange of buying membership. And I share with you knowledge and wisdom and expertise that you're not going to get anywhere else, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
All right. Well, Greg, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for doing this work. And I hope that this can help generate some support for you, which obviously is needed. And also just want to encourage you to take the time that you need to take care of yourself so you can keep doing the work that you're doing, because it definitely is necessary.
Yeah. So thank you, Martin. And let me just, before we end, like, thank you for your work. Like, I mean, incredible. Your Mushroom Wisdom book. Absolutely incredible. Well, all your books are incredible and all your work's incredible. And just thank you for everything you've done, you know, to share this experience with you and like to be at Theogenesis last year is probably one of the highlights of my life, you know, for real.
All right. Well, thank you for saying so. And it's always nice to connect with you. And just want to wish you the best on this court case, because it sounds like it's an important one.
Yeah. Thank you, Martin.
Illumination has come for all. Na 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 na. Bring a revelation, so let the truth be told. The earth, it has so many medications to heal the heart and free the mind. Their magic lies in their molecular formation, a gift so divine to open the heart, drop the protection, expand the facade of the incarceration. We are free as a bird right to know the true self as incarnate Illumination has come for all.